of an ear. The buck had bedded behind one of the fallen pines, its body concealed by the trunk and its massive antlers blending in perfectly with the single remaining branch that jutted skyward from the tree. But for that tiny movement, Rafe never would have seen him. Finding the deer was the first step. Now he had to make a plan to work himself within range. He traced a muddy creek bed backward from near the buck's position and figured that it would give him just enough terrain to crawl beneath the deer's line of sight. If he could make his way to the creek without being spotted, and could crawl the length of it without being heard, and if the wind didn't shift to blow his stalk, he might have a shot. He rolled to one side and shrugged off his pack, taking only his bow and quiver and what little was strapped to his body. He unclipped the Motorola two-way radio from his belt and laid it on top of the pack before backing over the ledge and out of sight of the valley below. He walked bent at the waist and to the left to put him in position to move down the ridge behind the buck. It gave him the wind's full advantage and made it less likely that the deer would spot his movement in its peripheral vision. Malusi would be proud. Chapter 39. Reese took his foot off the accelerator as they approached the ranch entrance and steered the cruiser through the steel gate that was visible from the road. The truck rumbled over the welded pipes of the cattle gap, and he punched the gas. He picked up the radio mic and made his third attempt at contact. "Reese, for Rafe, over." It would make sense that Rafe would have his radio turned down, assuming that he was still hunting. "Reese to Kumba Base, over." He waited a few seconds before repeating the call. "Reese to Kumba Base, over."
"Kumba Base here, go ahead, Reese."
It was the voice of Caroline Hastings.
"Kumba Base, we have an emergency. Tears on Kumba, over. I repeat, tears on Kumba."
He used the old Rhodesian vernacular for terrorist, which was a term that, as a veteran of the Bush War's home front, Caroline was more than familiar with.
"Roger, Reese. We will lock down here, over."
"Is Utalivu with you? Over,"
Reese asked, using the Shona nickname for Rafe, in case they were being monitored. There was a long pause.
"Negative, Reese. Over."
"Roger that. I'm bringing my friend to you for safekeeping. Over."
"Roger."
Reese drove at the absolute limits of his and the vehicle's abilities. As he skidded the Toyota to a stop next to the main house, he saw Jonathan, Liz, Thorne, Caroline, and Annika rush to meet him. Jonathan was carrying what looked like his old wartime FAL rifle at a high port, its crude green and brown baby shit camouflage paint job still evident after nearly three decades. He wore his daily work attire of boots, jeans, and a western shirt, but with a faded nylon chest rig strapped across his chest. His face was alert and his eyes were bright. He was in his element. Thorne had his bolt-action deer rifle in hand. Caroline carried a classic Breno Model 602 in one hand, its muzzle pointed skyward with her elbow locked into her hip. She stood beside Annika protectively, a stoic look on her face indicating that this wasn't the first time that she'd protected the family's home from armed men with bad intentions. She rushed to open the door for Katie and wrapped her with her free arm as she climbed from the SUV.
"Reese, what's happened?"
Jonathan asked.
"Not sure, sir. Katie and I received a call from the CIA on our way into town. They missed us, but not by much. The information we received says this is Russian mafia, and they are here for me and for Rafe. I am so sorry.
Never mind that now, son,"
Jonathan said, taking command.
"It sounds like they're just after the boys, but you never know. Caroline, it's just like the old days. You know what to do. Thorne, Liz, you stay here. There are ARs in the gun safe and a stack of loaded magazines next to them. Grab them and keep them close, in case those bastards get in the house. Annika, Katie, get in the vault and arm yourselves. But only lock yourselves in as a last resort in case these tears try to burn you out. We'll be back as soon as we get Rafe."
All nodded in unison, and Caroline led the other women quickly toward the house.
"Hop in," Reese said.
The older man nodded and opened the back door of the cruiser. He put two fingers in his mouth and whistled loudly.
"Zulu, come!"
On cue, the family hound came bounding around the corner of the house and jumped into the SUV without hesitation. Jonathan took a seat, the muzzle of his rifle resting between his feet. As soon as he slammed the passenger door, Reese hit the gas, spitting gravel as the cruiser fishtailed down the driveway. Chapter 40. Rafe's feet were soaked and numb from stalking through the icy creek. It was the only way to stay below the buck's vision. He moved at a painfully slow pace to reduce the noise signature, the glacial stream freezing his calves. When he was within 100 yards of the deer, he set down his bow and moved carefully onto the grassy bank. He unlaced his boots and set them aside on the dry land. Ordinarily, he would have made his final stalk wearing just his wool socks, but given their saturation, he was afraid that they might make a squishing sound, betraying his presence. He removed them as well and laid them out on the stalks of grass to air dry. He pulled the knit wool cap from his head and tore a handful of vegetation from the ground. Weaving the long strands into the fabric, he transformed the simple hat into a crown of local camouflage. He was on all fours now, crawling in the long grass the way he'd watched lionesses hunt in Africa. He wondered for a moment how many men had crawled through this same valley, bow or atlatl in hand, in pursuit of deer, elk, or even mammoths. It wasn't uncommon to find the flint artifacts of hunters past when the soil on the ranch was turned over by spring rains. He pulled the powder-filled sock from his hip pocket and gave it a shake to test the wind. It was light, but holding. He slipped it away and continued his slow crawl, his bow in his right hand. He put his weight on his knuckles so as not to damage the bow as he moved. It was slow going, but now was not the time to rush. Sneaking a peek, he saw that he was 60 yards from the branches of the fallen pine. A good shooter with a compound bow could take a shot on an animal of this size from where he knelt, but with a recurve, even an archer of his talents needed to cut that figure in half. Rafe eased back into a crawl and began to close the final yards. 40 yards. He slipped an arrow from the leather-covered quiver attached to the bow's frame and carefully knocked it onto the braided bowstring. He held the bow in his left hand, his pointer finger holding the arrow securely on its rest. In 10 more yards, Rafe would rise to both knees to keep his hips on a level plane and bring the bow to full draw. The buck would stand up and Rafe would have a split second to release the shot before the animal bounded out of range. His breathing was rapid, and his mind was totally focused on the next move, the next soft spot to place his hands and knees. Despite the cool morning temperatures, rivulets of sweat ran down his face. To Rafe, there was no feeling more natural, more human, than the stalk. He wrapped 2 fingers of his right hand around the string and purposefully relaxed his left hand's grip on the bow. His body rose slowly but deliberately, his eyes focused on the spot where he knew the buck's shoulder would be. Rafe's head was just clearing the crest of the grass stalks when he saw the buck lurch to his feet. It was always shocking how big these animals were at close range. Rafe froze. Something had spooked the buck, but his focus was over Rafe's head, toward the ridge behind him. The sixth sense. Morphing from hunter to warrior in less than a second, he sprinted forward as the ground around him came alive, eruptions of dirt showering upward and the unmistakable crack of supersonic rifle rounds passing nearby. Instincts hardwired from nearly 2 decades of sustained combat took over. His hands released the bow as he sprinted toward the tree that had been the buck's hiding spot, the Colt coming effortlessly from its leather holster as he ran. He could hear the incoming rounds chewing into the earth around him. Halfway to the tree, he dove the remaining yards, his body going fully horizontal as it flew for the only available cover. He hit hard on his belly and knees and rolled back the way he'd come, pressing his body against the trunk of ponderosa pine. Rounds impacted the thick wood fibers, but thanks to the velocity they'd lost on their way to the target, none penetrated completely through. There was no "why me" or "why now" clogging the former commando's consciousness. Instead, he was entirely focused on prevailing. He was lying on his side, body parallel to the trunk of the tree. He turned his head to ensure that no one was moving in on the ridge behind him.
Take a breath. Look around. Make a call.
Rafe took a moment to take stock of the situation. Multiple bad guys with Kalashnikovs. He'd been shot at by them enough times to know exactly what they sounded like. No sign of a belt fed, which was good news. He hoped that they didn't have an RPG. If there was a sniper among them, he'd already be dead, which meant they probably didn't have anything more capable than AKs or AKMs. He had a handgun that was designed when Taft was in the White House. It held 7 rounds in the magazine and 1 in the chamber. 2 more magazines were stowed in a leather pouch on his belt. The ridgeline where the fire was coming from was an honest 300 yards from his position, and it was farther, almost 500, to the next ridge behind him. He was essentially in the bottom of a gigantic bowl, hiding behind one of the only available pieces of cover. It wasn't good, but it could have been worse.
It can always be worse.
The creeks, such as the one through which he had just waded, all flowed into a swampy area to his left, which would be chest-high with water at the moment. That meant that when these guys started trying to flank him, they would have to do so from his right. The volume of fire coming his way became more sporadic as his attackers began to change magazines. He could hear someone yelling in a language other than English, no doubt their leader taking command of the situation. He must have directed them to conserve ammunition because the full auto bursts were replaced with a steady stream of semi-automatic fire designed to keep him in place so that they could maneuver to make the kill. Rafe low crawled to the extreme left end of the log and slowly began to ease his way forward until he could see one of the shooters. The first figure was prone, the dust from his rifle's muzzle blast giving away his position. He continued to push himself forward with his toes as he brought his 1911 to bear, searching for a larger target at this extreme range. The third figure he spotted must have been the leader. He was up on one knee, directing the other members of the team with his left arm. Rafe was in what was known as the rollover prone position, an incredibly steady way to shoot a handgun. The distance would have been unfathomable to most shooters, but Rafe's dedication to training with the 1911 at extreme handgun ranges was about to pay off. His thumb pushed down on the safety unconsciously as his hands brought the pistol to full extension. His eyes found the serrated front sight and held it at the midway point of the target's torso, the steel blade rising halfway above the rear notch to accommodate for the distance. He exhaled deeply and trusted the area wobble of his sights, all focus on the front post as his finger pressed evenly back against the trigger. The shot broke, and he completed his follow-through before shifting his eyes to the target in case a correction was needed. His ears registered the hollow sound of a large bullet slapping flesh, and he saw the distinctive Russian weapon drop to the ground. Reese raced down the dirt roads with both hands on the wheel, Jonathan directing him at each turn. He was familiar with the ranch, but no one knew the land the way Jonathan did. Reese could see Rafe's parked Land Rover as they came around a tight bend, and Jonathan motioned for him to stop. He rolled down the window to listen, and Reese shut off the motor. They heard the unmistakable sound of rifle fire in the distance. Jonathan considered the terrain for a moment and pointed forward on the track.
Drive up to this ridge and drop me off. You continue down this road and you'll likely come up on whoever is after Rafe. I know you can handle yourself.
Reese cranked the motor and sped up the incline ahead. The road took them up a ridge line that ran parallel to the direction of the gunfire. The ridge appeared to be the highest terrain feature in the area, so Reese would most likely come in above the action. Several hundred yards up the ridge, Jonathan motioned for Reese to slow down. He opened the passenger door while the cruiser was still rolling and prepared to bail out. As soon as the vehicle stopped, his boots were on the ground. Zulu jumped between the seats and followed her master out the door. Reese sped forward. He rolled all of the windows down and, thanks to the cruiser's effective exhaust system, could hear the gunfire clearly over the engine. By the sound of it, he was getting close. He braked to a halt just below the military crest of the next hill. He grabbed his carbine and climbed out of the SUV. Running to the rear of the vehicle, he opened the back hatch to retrieve a small backpack before moving on foot toward the sound of the guns. Chapter 41. The tempo of fire increased, indicating the flank had begun. This was Small Unit Tactics 101. One element provides a base of fire to fix the enemy in place, while the second element moves to close the distance and gain an improved fighting position. The covering team then leapfrogs ahead and takes up the next advantageous position until everyone on the objective is dead. Downrange, if found in such a scenario, against a numerically superior force, Rafe and his team would have used all of their firepower, as well as whatever fire support was available, to break contact with the enemy. This was different. He had no team, no real firepower, and certainly no fire support.
Oh, to have a radio and an AC-130 gunship circling overhead right now.
He turned his body around so that his head was facing the right side of the tree and eased his way forward, ever so slightly gaining an angle on the opposing ridge. The lead figure was running obliquely downhill toward Rafe at somewhere past 150 yards, AKM swinging as he sprinted forward. Rafe lay prone, his abdomen flat on the ground and his body aligned with the moving figure. He waited for the attacker to stop, since even he couldn't hit a moving target at this distance. The man took cover behind a boulder that left only his head exposed and immediately began raining accurate fire on Rafe's position. Rafe fired quickly, rushing the shot just a bit, and saw dust fly in the man's face as his bullet impacted the rock. He fired another round and slid back behind his rapidly disappearing cover just as a burst of fire stitched the ground in front of him, sending clods of dirt and pine fragments into his face. Rafe was about out of time. Another assaulter got a little too confident as he bounded past his team member behind the boulder, taking a knee in a spot high enough to allow him a direct line of fire into Rafe's position. He was rewarded with a hard ball to the lung that quickly took him out of the fight. These men were not fanatical fedayeen hopped up on amphetamines. They were street thugs used to getting by on bravado and intimidation. Rafe didn't know how many men he was up against, but it sounded like fewer than 10. He'd hit at least two of them. Still, the odds weren't good. Taking advantage of the moment, Rafe pulled a fresh magazine from his pouch and performed a tactical reload. He stuck the partially loaded mag in the back pocket of his pants, where he could reach it if necessary. The fire was intense, with multiple shooters putting rounds directly into Rafe's position. Only his attacker's mediocre marksmanship skills and a slight dip in the ground were keeping him from getting hit. He made himself as small a target as possible, hugging every inch of the terrain as rounds hissed and cracked over his head and pounded the ground in front of him. There was a lull as one of the shooter's magazines ran dry, and Rafe snuck a peek. Two men were bounding in to within 100 yards at a dead sprint. He snapped off two rounds in their direction, which sent them diving for cover. He didn't think about the fact that he'd survived multiple combat deployments targeting Al-Qaeda and ISIS and was about to get killed on his own ranch in Montana. Nor did he think about his pregnant wife just a few miles away. Instead, he thought about improving his fighting position and exploiting every technical and tactical advantage he could. If this was his last stand, he wasn't going to make it easy on them. The teams had a saying, "Don't rush to your death." There was hardly ever a good reason to go barging into a target at full speed without carefully assessing the situation. The one big exception was a hostage rescue mission where safety was sacrificed for speed in the name of protecting the hostage. There was another exception, when your friends were in trouble. From the sound of it, Rafe was in a really bad spot. Rhys heard at least a half dozen rifles firing from multiple positions, interrupted only by the occasional pop of what must have been Rafe's 45. He slowed his progress just for a second as he reached the top of the ridge and crawled the final few yards so as not to silhouette himself at the peak. The noise from the rifle fire rose abruptly.